Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome associate producer from Georgetown University, John Hasness.
Thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me here to talk about a very serious problem, the problem of white-collar crime. Dishonest business conduct, white-collar crime, is a serious social problem. It's rightly a very high priority with regard to enforcement measures. But on the other hand, so is child abuse. So I'd like to begin by asking you to consider the following situation. Imagine one day there's a knock at your door, and it's a prosecutor. And the prosecutor tells you that he believes that your neighbor is engaging in child abuse. He wants you to spy on your neighbor, peek in his window, monitor his activities. He wants you to do everything in your power to detect child abuse, including encouraging your neighbor to confide in you under promises of confidentiality. And then after you get any information under this promise, he wants you to turn it over to the prosecutor. He also tells you that if you don't do this, if you don't engage in these activities, he will indict you for child abuse. As an ethical person, under those circumstances, what should you do? You've been friendly with your neighbor. You think of him as a nice guy. You have no reason to believe that he's guilty of child abuse. And you also have no certainty that he's not. Maybe he is a child abuser. But a criminal indictment for child abuse would ruin your reputation. It would cost you your job. It would destroy your life. Your spouse and your children are depending on you. So what should you do? Well, that reaction suggests that some of you think that a law enforcement policy that places innocent and ethical citizens in this kind of position is not an acceptable one in a free society. But this is precisely the law enforcement approach that the federal government is employing in its prosecution of white-collar crime. Okay, my book, Trapped, is a critique of federal law and law enforcement policy. In the book, I argue that the federal government is waging a war against white-collar crime in a way that not only discourages corporations from meeting their ethical obligations to employees, but also prevents the corporations from adopting the most effective measures of reducing violations of law by their employees. My book is a criticism of the rules that give prosecutors too much power and pressure ethical business people into sacrificing the interests and the rights of their employees in order to protect their firms. So what are some of these rules? The first one I'll talk about is the legal standard for corporate criminal responsibility. Now, ethicists debate when it's appropriate to hold a corporation responsible for the wrongdoing of its employees. Some argue it's never appropriate. Why? Because the defining characteristic of a modern corporation is the separation of ownership and control. The shareholders don't control the actions of the employees. If you punish a corporation, you can't lock a corporation up. All you can do is fine it. Who pays the fine? The shareholders. So if you punish a corporation, you're punishing people who are innocent of wrongdoing. So some people will argue it's never appropriate to punish a corporation. Others argue it is. It's appropriate to punish a corporation when the wrongdoing is a matter of corporate policy. It's been signed off by those who make the higher level decisions. Others will argue that it's appropriate to hold a corporation responsible for the action of its employees when there's a corrupt corporate culture, when the corporation is run in such a way that people believe they can get ahead by cutting corners, by violating the law, when the corporation either encourages this or fails to adequately discourage it. These are interesting discussions. I recommend them to you. But they're all irrelevant to the standard for corporate criminal responsibility. Under our law, corporations are criminally responsible for all of the crimes committed by any of its employees that are taken within the scope of the employee's employment. It makes no difference whether the employee acted contrary to corporate policy. It makes no difference whether the employee was explicitly instructed not to take the action that he or she took. Corporations are strictly liable for any crimes committed by their employees. Also, there's another legal doctrine called the collective knowledge doctrine, in which corporations are held to have the knowledge of all of their individual employees. So if one employee knows one piece of information and another employee knows another piece of information, and if you assembled all of these pieces of information together, it would represent an action that's a violation of the law, then the corporation is guilty of an offense. Given that this is the standard for criminal corporate responsibility, there's an immediate implication, and that is that the only way for a corporation to obey the law is to prevent its employees from violating the law. Now, all business people know that their internal controls can never be perfect. No business can guarantee that there will be no rogue employees who violate corporate policies or committed a crime, violate the law. Beyond this, there's always the risk that employees will inadvertently violate the law. There's a lot of ways in which you can commit a crime without knowing that you're doing so under current federal law. There are many offenses that may be committed either negligently or innocently. They're called public welfare offenses. You don't even have to intend to be violating the law. If it occurs, you're guilty. But beyond that, even the offenses that require intent may be committed without realizing that you're violating the law. And the best example of this is probably the federal fraud offenses. Let me speak for a moment about what federal fraud is. And this is mail fraud, wire fraud, bank fraud, tax fraud, securities fraud, any of those offenses. Traditionally, fraud was, you committed fraud by making a misrepresentation of a fact that's material to someone's decision that another person relies on, and as a result of that reliance, loses property. So that's fraud. Federal fraud is not that. Federal fraud is essentially participating in any misleading or deceptive practice. The way the fraud statutes are written, the federal fraud statutes are written, there's no requirement that there be a misrepresentation of fact. There's no requirement that anybody rely on your deceptive practice. There's no requirement that there be any actual harm. There's no requirement that there be any loss of property. It's a fraud to deprive a company or a person of it or his or her intangible right to your honest services. All right, what does this mean? Well, in the words of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the reach of the federal fraud statutes is, quote, virtually limitless. If an employee uses company letterhead in a dispute with a landlord, according to the Second Circuit, that can be a federal offense. That can be federal fraud. I don't want to multiply examples, but to give you an idea of the way the federal fraud statutes can be used, let me refer you to the case of Martha Stewart. Everyone knows she was convicted of obstruction of justice. But she was also tried for securities fraud. That charge was dismissed, not because it was an improper charge, it was dismissed for lack of evidence. So what was the nature of Martha Stewart's securities fraud? She went on the Barbara Walters television show and said she was innocent of insider trading. And for that action, the federal government charged her with fraud. Now you can see how that's securities fraud, because by saying she's innocent, she was intentionally making a false statement designed to prop up the stock price of her company, Martha Stewart OmniMedia, and that's securities fraud. So that example is designed to show that it's very possible to be guilty of an offense like fraud without knowing that you're violating the law. I think it's probably safe to say Martha Stewart didn't know she was committing a federal offense when she declared her innocence on national television. But under these circumstances, all that responsible managers can do is try to guard the corporation against the possibility that the actions of one or more of its employees will place the corporation in legal jeopardy. What can a manager do to protect the corporation in this way? Well, the answer to that question is determined by the organizational sentencing guidelines and the Department of Justice's Thompson Memorandum. The organizational sentencing guidelines determine the size of a company's fine if it's convicted of a criminal offense. There are only two things a firm can do to reduce its potential fine. It can have an effective compliance program, and it can cooperate with the government. The Thompson Memorandum contains the Department of Justice's policy governing whether to indict a corporation in the first place. And the Thompson Memorandum incorporates the features of the guidelines. To avoid indictment, a corporation should have an effective compliance program and must cooperate with the government. So what exactly does this mean? To have an effective compliance program, you must have a program that monitors and audits the conduct of your employees in order to detect and prevent criminal activity. Another feature of having an effective compliance program is that there has to be adequate discipline of individuals that are responsible for any wrongdoing. What's cooperation? Cooperation requires acceptance of responsibility, self-reporting, and disclosure of all pertinent information. Acceptance of responsibility is interesting. Acceptance of responsibility means the first thing the company must do is essentially, or the equivalent, of pleading guilty. Because according to the guidelines, the adjustment for cooperation is not intended to apply to an organization that puts the government to its burden of proof at trial by denying the essential factual elements of guilt. Now think about it. How can a corporation, what does it mean for a corporation to accept responsibility for criminal wrongdoing? Under our law, the only way a corporation can commit a crime is if its employees have committed a crime. So acceptance of responsibility means the first thing a corporation must do is declare that its employees have violated the law. Cooperation requires corporations to accuse their employees of criminal activity. Essentially, what it requires is a presumption of guilt on the part of the employees rather than a presumption of innocence. Now, since you must begin by accepting responsibility, which means saying that your employees are culpable, the next thing that you have to do to cooperate is to refuse to support culpable employees. What does that mean? Well, for one thing, it means you have to fire them if they refuse to cooperate with the government, if they put on a defense. You should refuse to advance their attorney's fees, which is a big issue in the current KPMG case. You have to refuse to enter into joint defense agreements with them. Essentially, you must cut them off and do whatever you can to help the government prove them to be guilty. And the other thing you must do to cooperate is you must disclose all pertinent information. That means, according to the Department of Justice, you must waive your attorney-client and work product privileges and reveal to the government anything that would normally be protected by that privilege. You must also turn over the results of all internal investigations and disclose any confidential information in your possession to the government. So, the way of summing this up is, the only action a corporation can take to protect itself against legal liability is to enlist as a deputy prosecutor. The law and law enforcement policy essentially requires corporations to act as deputies of the Department of Justice. What the book is about is what are the ethical implications of this structure of law and law enforcement policy? So I'll ask you to consider some of the ethical considerations. Let's begin by asking, what's the purpose of enforcing the law against white-collar crime in the first place? I should say, what's the purpose of enforcing a law against corporate criminality? The answer probably, or in my opinion, has to be something like this. It's to reduce law-breaking by those engaged in business. Well, if that's the purpose, what's the best way to do that? Actually, a great deal is known about this. People who do what's called organizational behavior research have done a lot of studying, and they have shown that the best way to reduce employee rule breaking or law breaking is a lot of features. Mostly, it involves treating the employees with respect. That means that you should not constantly monitor your employees' activities. You don't want to make them feel like they're being spied on all the time. You should reward trustworthy behavior with trust. Something important is to honor all your promises very strictly to your employees. You should also undertake serious self-assessment to discover potential wrongdoing as early as possible. You should rigorously adhere to programs of procedural justice. And this involves taking swift action against those whose wrongdoing has been established by fair procedures and rewarding those who behave ethically. Now, how does this work? Apparently, this works by aligning employees' personal values with the corporation's, and that increases employees' commitment to follow the corporation's rules. It reduces lawbreaking. More significantly, when employees feel that they're being treated fairly by the corporation, they're more willing to come forward and inform management about those within the organization who are breaking the rules. The other people breaking the rules now seems like an offense against the individual, not just an offense against the impersonal corporation. So this is essentially the way that you can reduce employee lawbreaking most effectively. Well, what's the effect of federal law and law enforcement policy? Let's consider a few areas. Let's do privacy first. Employees don't have the same right to privacy in the workplace that they possess at home. In the workplace, employees may be monitored to ensure that they're capable of doing their jobs and that they're in fact doing them. But that doesn't imply that employers have carte blanche to investigate every aspect of an employee's life, even if it's not job-related. Further, the research shows if you do engage in this kind of oppressive spying on your employees and investigating every aspect of their life, it tends to create an oppressive working environment. It reduces employee efficiency in many ways. It undermines the corporate environment most conducive to rule following. But in order to have an effective compliance program, what must you do? You must monitor and audit your employees' behavior to detect and prevent criminal conduct. What can that mean? Criminal conduct, business crime, is always disguised to look like legal behavior. If you're talking about fraud, that can be simply deceptive behavior. What level of monitoring is required to detect this kind of wrongdoing? More than simply monitoring someone for job performance, more than ordinary monitoring, I can't answer the question for you about what's required. I can tell you this, that there are many consulting companies, Deloitte and Touche are among them, that offers corporations a service, and the service is that they will come in and create psychological profiles of the employees of the business in order to help the businesses identify those most likely to engage in violations of law. And these profiles will include things like marital status, stress in life, recreational activities that people may not want others to know about. So the legal incentives are to violate employees' privacy to a very high degree, which I'll say, or I'll offer to you, may be inconsistent with a business's ethical obligations to refrain from taking actions like that. Another implication has to do with confidentiality. To run an ethical business, managers have to know what's going on in their firm. Most businesses attempt to acquire information of potential wrongdoing by promising employees who come forward confidentiality. Typically, this is done in two ways. You create an employee hotline, which you guarantee any information that comes through the hotline will be confidential, or you encourage people to talk to corporate counsel under the attorney-client privilege. But whenever a communication through the hotline or to corporate counsel suggests possible criminal activity within the firm, the corporation must disclose it to the government or risk indictment and increased fines. This means the responsible manager must choose between protecting the corporation and reducing its promise of confidentiality to a fraud. Now, you might assume that an ethical business could avoid this dilemma by not making a promise of confidentiality that it knows it will have to breach. That won't work either, though. Failure to provide a confidential mechanism for reporting possible criminal conduct would mean that the company doesn't have an effective compliance program. Sarbanes-Oxley actually requires this in certain cases. Now, businesses could honestly tell employees that any putative confidential information that the employees turn over to them will be shared with prosecutors. But then, who will use the hotline or talk to a corporate counsel? Anyone who knows anything they say will go straight to the prosecutors is probably going to wisely keep his or her mouth shut. Another ethical area to consider is organizational justice. Do businesses have any ethical obligations to treat their employees fairly? If a corporation knows that its employees have knowingly and intentionally violated the law on the basis of a fair investigative process, there's probably no problem in cooperating with the government. But what about the other possibilities? Maybe the employee's innocent, or the corporation just doesn't know whether the employee is innocent or guilty. And the vagueness of many of these new offenses, like federal fraud, makes the second a serious possibility. It's hard to tell whether an employee has committed an offense or not. Under those circumstances, don't loyal employees who come under suspicion have some claim to fair treatment? Aren't they entitled to a minimum presumption of innocence in the sense that no adverse action will be taken against them in the absence of some adequate evidence of wrongdoing? But to cooperate with the federal government and protect the firm against indictment or greater fines, businesses must begin by accepting responsibility, which means declaring their employees to be guilty. How can managers give their employees even a modicum of due process while firing them if they decide to mount a defense, refusing to advance their attorney's fees, and becoming part of the government's prosecution team? All right. Another area is self-assessment. Businesses typically employ corporate counsel to undertake ethical and legal self-assessment in order to learn what aspects of corporate practice need correcting. But any self-assessment that suggests a possible violation of law triggers a duty to self-report and disclose the information to the government. That means waiving your attorney-client privilege. And when you waive attorney-client privilege to report wrongdoing to prosecutors, it's waived. There's no such thing as selective waiver. It's waived to the world, which means you're not just telling the prosecutors, you're telling every plaintiff's attorney out there that there was wrongdoing in your corporation. So self-assessments now invite not only criminal prosecution, but civil lawsuits. Many businesses now judge performing self-assessments like this as too risky to undertake. There's also the matter of trust. The only way to encourage trustworthy behavior in one's employees is to trust them. And this means to refrain from constantly looking over their shoulders and monitoring their behavior and spying on them all the time. The more trust a corporation reposes in its employees, the more it exposes itself to risk of legal liability. The more trust it puts in its employees, the more it does not have what the law considers an effective compliance program. Ferreting out potential criminals requires deceptive or at least secret monitoring practices. The more a firm responds to the legal incentives, the more it erodes the climate of trust within the firm itself. The organizational behavior research shows that there are two approaches to reducing employee lawbreaking: the command and control approach and the procedural justice approach. The research shows that the command and control approach that involves intense monitoring of employee activity and strict punishment policies can, in fact, reduce employee lawbreaking, but not very much. The research also shows that the procedural justice approach that involves treating employees as though they may be trusted and rigorously adhering to programs of organizational procedural justice is a significantly more effective way of reducing employee lawbreaking. And finally, the research shows that these two approaches cannot be used together. The monitoring of the command and control approach undermines the trust necessary to make the procedural justice approach work. fear of undeserved punishment under the command and control approach means that the employees don't commit themselves to the corporation in the same way. Present federal law enforcement policy threatens firms who are, I'll skip a couple of these. That's the requirements for an ethical corporate culture that I had before. These are the incentives of federal law and law enforcement policy. Spy on employees, violate your promises of confidentiality, don't trust your employees, refrain from self-assessment, do not adhere to the requirements of procedural justice, punish all suspected of wrongdoing, not those that are clearly guilty of wrongdoing, and punish ethical behavior when it's necessary for cooperation. So present federal law and law enforcement policy threatens firms who adopt the more effective procedural justice approach with indictment and increased penalties. Respect for the privacy of your employees, trusting them, failure to monitor them, all of that means you don't have an effective compliance program. Giving employees a presumption of innocence, treating them with due process, that's a failure to cooperate. If the object of law enforcement is the reduction of violations of law by employees, then I'll say that the current federal policy is a very ineffective one. On the other hand, if the object of law enforcement is to increase the number of guilty pleas and convictions that the Department of Justice can obtain, the present policy is a very effective one indeed. So let me close with this question, which is the one I started with. What is the purpose of enforcing the law against white-collar crime? Because if it's to reduce employee law-breaking, the law and the policies we're using today are the wrong ones to be trying. Thank you. Okay. I see my time's not up, so if you have any questions. Sure.
Ellen Cousins, Primos Research. The question that I had is, where I agree with the conflict, I mean, we see it every day what I do, what do you do to, if you abandon the system that we have now, what do you do about organizations that are, thank you, what do you do about organizations that are organizationally deviant, that are corrupt from top to bottom, where the policies are corrupt and illegal and horrible? How do we properly enforce the laws against those companies, and some of them you know and some of them you don't?
You mean like Enron?
For example.
Hey, think about Enron. Enron wasn't prosecuted. The individuals who engaged in the wrongdoing were the ones who were prosecuted. If you want to attack corporate criminality, prosecute the people who commit the offenses. When you prosecute a corporation, you're prosecuting all of those who didn't commit the offense. One reason why Enron wasn't prosecuted was, if you prosecuted Enron, who would pay a fine? The shareholders who are out of all the money anyway. The purpose of corporate criminality is not to punish criminal wrongdoing. It's to force corporations to join the Department of Justice and become law enforcement agents, which turns the corporations against their own employees. You want vigorous enforcement against individuals, that's one way. I'll say this. This is not my position, but a respectable position is you prosecute corporations when you can prove that there's corporate wrongdoing, like a corrupt corporate culture, like Enron, then go after them. But at least let corporations that do everything they can to behave ethically, not be guilty of an offense, right? If you can't be prosecuted, if you have an ethical corporate culture and that's a defense, now you don't have to fear indictment. Now you don't have to fear increased fines. Now you can have the luxury of treating your employees fairly because you have a defense. So changing the law to require actual corporate wrongdoing for corporate punishment would solve a lot of the problems. Anything else? Yes.
My name is Don Alford. Do these laws apply to other organizations such as not-for-profit?
Absolutely. I've been talking in terms of corporation. He asked whether it applies to other organizations.
Do
They're the organizational sentencing guidelines. They apply to corporations. They apply to partnerships. They apply to labor unions. They apply to organizations. Even if you're a nonprofit, you have to worry about these things. You only have to worry about it if the DOJ decides they want to come after you, but you still probably should worry about it a bit.
Stephen Sprague from Wave Systems. Isn't one of the, really interesting challenges when we look at things like SOX compliance, et cetera, that in essence the corporations are writing rules that they have to follow, policies, that in many aspects there are huge opportunities for conflict because the rules are never really tested until the corporation actually does something wrong. And then there's almost an assurance that they're always out of compliance. So there's always something they've done wrong. Email policies are a perfect example where, you know, did you have a BlackBerry in your corporation? You're probably in violation of your SOX email policy in that context.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I don't even need to speak about Sarbanes-Oxley. The basic fundamental federal laws that govern business behavior, like the fraud offenses itself, is enough. It's, if a prosecutor wants to get you, he or she probably can. The line between legal and illegal behavior is now so indistinct that you won't know that you've crossed it until after you're convicted, when things are resolved. And as bad as things were in Enron, the reason why they got that way is because they decided to see how close to the legal rules they could come and get and stay technically within them. And of course, that involved a lot of very bad behavior, which after the fact looked like it was illegal. But the indistinct nature of the rules themselves do mean that it's very difficult to know ahead of time when you're safe. And that's exactly the reason why corporations turn against their employees, since they can never be confident that their employees acted legally. They can never be confident that they're on safe grounds. The only recourse they have is to immediately cooperate, which means declare themselves to be guilty. I don't want to take up too much time, but if you look at what happened at KPMG, that's exactly the case. For years, they declared that their tax shelters were legal. Apparently, they've got a letter from somebody at the IRS saying they don't have to be registered, but as soon as they came under investigation, they rolled over, they declared themselves guilty, and they turned on their own employees, and that's what's happening in that case right now. I think my time is up. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senior Vice President, Optical Communications Group, JDSU, Mr. Michael Rickey.
Good afternoon. So the agenda for this afternoon is to talk about the dream of the all-optical network. And you may recall during the heyday of probably 98, 99, when optical was booming, there was a lot of excitement about the concept of the all-optical network. I'd actually like to take a stand back and initially talk about why did people believe there was a need for an all-optical network, and look at maybe what some of the trends were in the industry, or perhaps some of the drivers for this. So if we look at that, going back to 99, what were the drivers at that time in terms of why do we need big pipes? Candidly, the first